Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
The Denisons, the Denisons, the busiest in the biz. You do know who it is, it's Dennis Quaid. That's him.
Hi, this is Dennis Quaid. On this episode of the Denisons, I'll be speaking with John Carter Cash, the only child of June Carter and Johnny Cash. We'll be talking about music, about family, and quite a few other things. So listen in. And the interview takes place from the legendary Cash Cabin recording studio outside of Nashville. Hope you enjoy.
So, John, you're at the cabin, it looks like. And the cabin being the cabin, the house of Cash, make music. And I've been in that cabin before. It's you can feel. It's a very weighty feel being in there. You can feel it in the walls, in the in that chair that I sat in, where your dad had etched his initials into the arm of it.
Yes, yes.
Thank you for letting me come over there and just feel that place.
For sure, brother. Yeah, I mean, there's so much energy in this wood, you know.
Well, there's Abbey Road, you know, there's Capitol here in Hollywood. There's Muscle Shoals, there's Sun Records, and then there's the cabin.
Well, yeah, there's us on the outskirts that perhaps that aren't as well known, and we're just fine with that. But man, you know, yes, I mean, my father, in the last part of his, you know, his life, he recorded a lot of music here. He worked starting with you know, with Rick Rubin back in the early 1990s here in the cabin, and before that actually my aunt Anita, my mother's sister, her youngest sister, recorded an album in here, and the band consisted of some wondrous musicians, Pat McLaughlin and some other wonderful people, Mark Howard, but one of her old friends was also one of the folks that was here, and that was Chet Atkins. And so one of the first people that ever recorded in the cabin was Chet Atkins, who, of course, you know, was one of the 20th century's greatest guitar players.
How did the idea for the cabin start?
Well, my father, he bought 160 acres there and around that on Old Hickory Lake in Hendersonville, Tennessee, in 1967, I do believe. And that was a year before he married my mother, and, you know, 3 years before I was born. But he bought that land, and there was the house that was on the lake, and then across the street from it, it was all woods. And when I was, 5 or 6 years old, my father said, how about a zoo, son? Sort of. And fenced in around 50 acres, you know, with 6-foot fence and barbed wire.
Was it a place at first, though, to go just to get away by himself?
Yeah, exactly. And that was it. He'd get home from the road, and it was, you know, it was louder at home than it was on the road, sometimes at the office, not at the house. And so he'd want a place to find respite. So the cabin itself was built in 1979, but the compound existed before the cabin, and it was filled with various animals. There were buffalo, there were wild Russian boar, which are completely illegal to have in Tennessee now. But back in the 1970s, it was different. It had fallow deer, black buck antelope, ostrich, emu, all these different animals, but within that compound is where he said, you know, I really want to find a place that that I can just sort of go get away if I want to. And so the cabin was built in 1979, just a, you know, one room cabin with a small bathroom and an upstairs loft where there were three beds. And he and I would come over, and we, you know, I'd watch Abbott and Costello movies. I would watch Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, and that was my favorite film at the time when I was 10 years old, and I'll never forget it. Over and over and over. And Dad would sit behind me over, you know, at the table, and he would write. He would tool around in the kitchen, and he would cook, and then we'd stay here. And then, the next morning, we'd get up and go back to the house. And maybe once a week when we were home, if we were home for a period of time, we'd do that, or just every once in a while. And so, but in the early 1990s, you know, that became there'd been a lot of life lived between 1980 and the early 1990s, but my father decided, you know, hey, I want to go into my cabin and start making music. And so he asked his engineer if he would bring in this 8-track Mackie board. And there's actually some things that were recorded on the first American Recordings record, titled American Recordings, within the original cabin.
Mm-hmm. Incredible. So it started out small, and then just it grew to what it is. Now it's really one of the icons of recording studios, I believe. I mean, growing up there with your dad, it sounded to me in the talks that we've had, you were your dad's little buddy. You were the only son with how many sisters that you've got?
I had six half sisters. One of my sisters passed away, my mother's second daughter. But my father was married once before, my mother twice before she married my father. And so I have five surviving half sisters right now. Roseanne, the eldest, and Carlene, my mother's eldest daughter, right under Roseanne, followed by Kathy, Cindy, and Tara.
And so growing up as the only son, and now your parents, both of them are gone. Mm-hmm. And do you see yourself as the patriarch of the family now? I'd be interested to know, because, you know, I know that myself, my identity within the family has changed over my life. And I'd be interested to know how your identity of yourself has changed.
A very, very much flawed patriarch. I am no Abraham, my friend. However, my father will always be the patriarch in my head, truly. And it's his guidance and moral stature that to me is what is beautiful and brilliant. And also, it's something that he lent to me, and explained to me tried to educate me in the way that he saw things, and he also encouraged me to think things through for myself and to try to decide, you know, hey, how do I see things really? It's not necessarily what, you know, my father, well, he wasn't like the dictator, but it's like, this is how you do it, this is what you do, you know. He was the kind of person that just said, you know, here's what I would do, and follow your own path, but I'm here if you need me, and figure it out for yourself. And my parents maybe should have been a little tougher on me, you know, when I was growing up. But, you know, I mean, the guidance of the high moral standards.
What kind of a dad was he? Was he any kind of a disciplinarian?
No. He actually... He only spanked me once that I remember it, and I know it was only once because he told me that later. But and I was probably 2.5 years old, and maybe 3.5 or 4, because it was after I'd started going on stage and performing, and I walked out on stage at the end of Boy Named Sue every night when I was little, and he'd say, "And if you ever had a boy," and he'd say, "And here he is, John Carter Cash," and I'd come out and take
after
him out.
Boy Named Sue, right?
Yeah, and he'd hand me the microphone. He'd say, "You got anything to say, son?" And I'd say, "Oh, yeah," and I'd have a little joke that he would teach me or whatever. Right. But this night, I grabbed the microphone and just started talking and just would not stop. And so a couple of my sisters were there, maybe more than a couple, I'm not sure, but my mother was there, and they all saw me doing that. And it was like, especially back in the 70s, they were like, okay, you know, you're going to spank him, right? And so my father, he took me back in the dressing room, and we sat down, and I remember his big, tall leather boots, And he said, okay, son. All right. Okay. Hold on. Turn sideways. And he just barely took his hand and just went whoop on my hiney butt, which what do you call the rear end.
Yeah.
But he, you know, I mean, it was just more like a love pat. It was like, pump. Okay. You know, and so, but that was the spanking. And it didn't hurt. And he knew it didn't hurt. No, he was not, you know, he wasn't a disciplinarian.
How about your mom?
No. You know, they came from different stuff. My father was always peaceful. You know, and I know that, you know, his father never raised his hand to me. His father never raised his hand to him. And he said that on a number of times. And he never raised his hand to me. But my mother, you know, she perhaps had more of a disciplinary nature, but still there were very, very few spankings. I've written about that, you know, in my books and stuff. My parents, they had this nature in them that they were so loving, and so tender and kind and joyous and all encompassing with that love. There was no anger towards anyone. So that never arose. And then there was always a kindness that if there ever was discipline, the kindness was in place of anything else. Always first.
Yeah. Growing up, my dad wasn't much of a disciplinarian either. It was mostly my mom. There were a couple of times my brother and I deserved spankings, and he would come in there and he would go through the whole motions of taking his belt out and snapping it
stuff.
There was somehow we figured out a way to crack him, make him laugh, and then it was all over. Growing up in your family, you went from being the baby of the family to you are the patriarch of the family, and you carry it very well, I think.
Thank you, my friend.
Keeping alive the legacy and also moving the leg and broadening it keeping it for everybody.
You know, and that's it. The foundation of what has happened since he passed away was established on the work that he began and the integrity in which it contained. And then since then, we always try to be very, very careful, very slow to make decisions and really, really try to, you know, to feel like we're doing something that he would do. But at the same time, my father was the kind of person that would say, maybe you don't want to do everything just exactly as I would do it all the time. Because my father was flawed and I'm flawed and we're all flawed. But, you know, he had his addictions and his struggles and whatnot. And he wrote about them. I mean, you know, they're all there for people to read and whatnot. Right. But what is his higher mind? I don't always know. But he did have one. He did have a higher mind, and also he had a higher power, and he called it God. And so that strength that was in him, you know, it passes on down through generations upon generations. If we can tap into it and open our hearts to it, that's sort of how I believe.
Well, you grew up on the road with them, and when did you learn to play the guitar? And did your dad teach you, or did your mom teach you?
My father. Wrote out on when I was 10 years old, he wrote out how to play a Walk the Line and where to put your fingers on the keys. He drew a little schematic of where your fingers would go to make a G and a C and a D on a guitar, and he gave that to me at 10 years old, and I still have it, but it, you know, framed. But now, because it definitely sets up, you know, it gave me a seed that grew. But it wasn't until I was 13 that I picked up the guitar, and it's because I wanted to learn to play like Angus Young from AC/DC. You know, I didn't wasn't really interested in Maybelle Carter or playing like my father or you know, playing like Chet Atkins or whoever. All I wanted to do was play screaming heavy metal guitar. And so
you feel like you had a rejection kind of in rebellion of the.
I think in my teenage wasteland, in my teen angst, I just rocked. That's just it. I mean, I just, you know, I loved rock and roll, and all my friends did. It was just, you know, the commonality, and it wasn't my dad, my mother, father. They were very receptive to my, you know, to my music. They were very receptive to my enjoying music. We had I had a bedroom down the hall from where they would sit and watch television, and there was actually a round bed that I looked out over the lake when I was young. So we took the mattress off of that bed and we put a drum set on it. So that there was a drum set on that round bed by the lake in my father's old house for years and years. And so we'd play heavy metal so loud, you know, it's like it had to be reverberating the whole house when I was 14, 15 years old. My mother and father.
How did they handle that?
Well, they would just turn up the television a little bit louder so that they could hear it. You know, back then he didn't have any headphones or whatever.
But they wouldn't say, hey, stop that racket.
No, never once remember him knocking on the door, my mother knocking on the door. And
nobody's stopping anybody playing music in that house, no matter what, right?
But I'm the guy, and, you know, I'm the guy who knocks on the door and says, turn down your music. but my father never did. My mother never did.
Yeah, well, like, you grew up playing, and did you want to be a musician, a singer, or songwriter? What was your first ambition that you can remember what you wanted to be, you know, as a child?
Well, I mean, as far as, when I was very young, you know, looking up at my father on the stage, you know, seeing this towering figure above me, you know, I think I imitated him. I wanted to be like him when I was very young, 3, 4, 5 years old. You know, as I got a little bit older, by the time I was a teenager, all I wanted to do was play hard rock. And so I didn't want to be Johnny Cash anymore. I just wanted to be my own rock guy.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people would be, you know, envious that you got to grow up around. What better education could you get? About music. But
I wanted to be a performer.
Was there a downside in that?
Yeah, definitely. But I wanted to be a performer, you know. But by the time, you know, I was in my 20s and whatnot, when I started working in music in the studio, it occurred to me, hey, I can do it here. I can work in the studio, and I don't have to go out there on the road anymore. It was really, right when Dad stopped touring, it started slowing down a little bit. And so that's when I started producing music. That's when I started recording my own music, is how I got into production in the first place. It's just by recording my own music. And then from there, my mother came to me because she knew I'd been working in the cabin and recording stuff. She said, how do you feel about co-producing an album for me? This is my mom. In the late 90s, and I'm like, yeah, okay, all right. And so I got in with a guy named J.J. Blair, and that was really how I cut my teeth in the studio, was working with my mother on an album called Wildwood Flower. And, so I co-produced with J.J., and I'm really, really, you know, so grateful for having that apprenticeship in the studio. But it went completely, the whole idea, you know, I feel like sometimes we change our dreams, you know? Mm-hmm. We trade one dream for another. And we realize that maybe the dreams that we've had, they're not what we really wanted in the first place. And so, when I found what I feel like I really wanted in the first place, then I stayed there.
And that would be as a...
Directing films and being an actor.
Yeah.
I'm just joking, Dennis.
Producing. Producing records.
Yeah, producing records. Yeah. But I did produce a short film, you know, going to be coming out very soon. We won some awards. It's called Dragon Song. So, and I'm in it. But anyway, Dragon Song should be coming out very good. I'm not going to announce the date yet, but it's like really soon.
Oh, I can't wait to see it. And you and I are making music videos together.
Man, I'm excited. Yeah, we'll see.
You know, I just want to stay on that growing up thing and how we were focused as kids and what we wanted to do. And you were doing your music. And then you worked with Jack Clement, who was my mentor, actually, since 1980. He was the original engineer at Sun Studios. He wrote your dad's first hit. Dream on Teenage Queen you told me a story of one time when you were going over to do a session with Jack Clement and how you didn't show up. What you had learned from that.
I booked it as a producer, but I was gonna work on some of my stuff, and then I was gonna do something with this other artist that I was working with, and I didn't show up. And this was in the late 1990s. But I grew up with Jack, and you know, Jack was an ex-Marine, you know, and never really stopped being a Marine, and that was it. That was inside his spirit and his soul, you know. And so, he had a great love and laughter and whatever, and you know, he'd smoke it up, man. But I learned so much from Jack. I really did. I went you know, to, I mean, at one point I called him up, say, I want to book the session. I didn't show up. So he called me, and suddenly when I got on the phone, I was talking to a Marine. And yeah. he said, you know, you have to follow through with what you say you're going to do. You have to, you know, and you're not going to do that again. If you book another session for me, you're going to show up or you're going to call early. And I forget that kind of thing sometimes. I make mistakes, you know, I do, you know, but having a very passive father figure, maybe Jack Clement should have just gone ahead and spanked my bottom when I was 27 years old. Things would have been a lot better later, but yeah, you know, I did, I've learned so much from Jack in my life, and I still carry a lot of that. The rules that he set for a studio recording
that are inside the cabin.
Yeah, that are in the cabin. You know, one of them is do not wear headphones. So, but anyway, don't bring guests and whatever to sessions. And then the different rules that he put together, they're more comical than they are really anything.
Remember to have fun.
I think that was number one actually.
Yeah, they call it playing.
Yeah, we're in the business of fun, you know, do not forget it. Yeah. And so, you know, it only takes 3 minutes to record a hit. That's what, you know, that came from Cowboy.
That's right.
Yeah. It's on the rules, and I know he wrote them in the early 1960s. So forgive me if someone else did write that before that.
Hey, Dennis Quaid here. You may know that I'm a musician and a huge music fan, and I want to tell you about a new podcast that I discovered. I've been listening to Eric Krasno Plus One, a podcast hosted by Grammy Award-winning guitarist and producer Eric Krasno. I love the interviews. They go deep with musicians, and you hear stories of life in the studio, life on the road. Those are really good, or bad, depending on which side of the story you're on. You got stories with bandmates and all the other shenanigans that go on behind the scenes. On Plus One, Eric has candid conversations with legendary musicians, many who are also his friends. And at the end of each episode, Eric plays a favorite track from his guest. So it's great for discovering new music, too. On Plus One, Eric has candid conversations with legendary musicians, many who are also his friends. And at the end of each episode, Eric plays a favorite track from his guest. So it's great for discovering new music, too. Eric's talked to people like Dave Matthews, Marcus King, Chris Robinson, and upcoming episodes feature conversations with John Mayer, Questlove, Derek Trucks, Phil Lesh, and so many more. So take a listen to Eric Krasno Plus One. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere you get your podcast.
Hi, Dennis Quaid here. Hey, we all have tough days and things that interfere with our happiness or achieving our goals. If you are looking to better yourself, then you should look into BetterHelp. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. BetterHelp evaluates what you need and connects you to your very own licensed professional therapist. You'll be connected in less than one day, and you can send messages to your counselor anytime, day or night. This is not self-help, but it is professional counseling from the comfort of your own home. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you could schedule your own weekly video or phone sessions. Confidential, convenient, professional, and affordable. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/Quaid. Join over 800,000 people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Quaid.
Was there anything from your dad that you learned not to do? I know I have several things with my dad because, like you said, we're all flawed and we're all searching around in the dark sometimes about things. And I looked at my dad, and there were so many things I loved about him, his nature, his loving nature. He was, he played piano. He was very funny, and he was great with people, a people person, but he was also very undisciplined himself.
Oh, yeah. And,
you know, not a lot of follow through.
I'm trying to remember what year did you do Great Balls of Fire? What year would it have been that you were...
That was 1987.
Oh dear. Yeah. Oh yeah, man. He was full of laughter then, but he was very focused. Dad was, he was pretty together in 1987, and but he was so full of fun, you know. And he was working with Cowboy, and he'd done a lot. And then he was on Polygram Records, and would have been the year before maybe that he recorded Water from the Wells poem. And I'm actually on it with him. So this during that time period, you know, that I was in the cabin a whole lot. But yeah, man, I mean, I remember going to the cabin, and I remember when our friend David Ferguson was in that film with you. You know, I think who did he play? Jack Clement, of course.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, David Ferguson was.
He was 22 years old. David Ferguson was the protege of Jack, and his engineer for him.
Yeah, he's a producer now. You know, I mean, of course, he's working with Dan Auerbach, and did Sturgill Simpson's last record with him, and co-producing and whatnot. And but he's doing a whole lot of great work still now. But yeah, man, Cowboy Jack Clement, he was like unto nobody else that I knew, and he was somebody that I wanted to be, and I wanted to be strong natured, and I wanted to make music, and I wanted to have fun. And I wanted to watch from afar when I needed to, because that's how Cowboy was. He would pull back and he'd let things go, let the musicians do what they did, and he'd come back in when he needed to. Sometimes and
he always wanted to make you your best self.
Yeah. But he had a distinct vision, you know, for tracks and how they'd be created and whatnot. So you know, between him and then the minimalistic recordings of Rick Rubin, you know, that a lot of that had to do with how I developed my production stuff.
Yeah. But yeah, growing up too, like I know like my father, that a couple of things that I learned, I didn't want to drink like my dad. My dad did drink a bit much. And, you know, that's kind of the thing that really kind of affected my growing up, childhood, was sometimes, you know, the amount of alcohol that he would drink.
Yeah,
you know, and it wasn't even discussed back then in terms of you know, alcoholics or whatever. You know, people just drank too much, and it was and it really wasn't talked about. And then, you know, I found myself getting older, and I ran into the same problems with addiction.
Exactly.
In my life, and you know, all started out as fun, and then fun with problems, and then just finally problems. Mm-hmm. In particular, cocaine, and you know, alcohol goes along with that. Mm-hmm. You know, something that was ongoing for a number of years, and you know, caused a lot of wreckage and damage in my life.
Yeah.
And your father's struggle with that is well known. And recently, you wrote in your book about your mom's struggles towards the end of her life that came to light.
There's a great documentary called The Gift that's on YouTube The Trust and myself, the Johnny Cash Trust and June Carter Trust and myself work very close to. And I feel like personally, even though it does, you know, sort of come from us, I feel like it is the closest thing to the truth, you know, as far as an overview of my father's life. But my dad, and when I was born, he was completely sober. He'd taken speed and whatnot and barbiturates through the 1960s. He straightened up in early 1968, late 1967, somewhere in there, and married my mother. And by the time I was born, he was on a roll. He'd had a number one television series, and you know, I can't remember if it was ABC what it was, but he had a number one hit television show for three seasons, and it was a live music show. But then through my young years, my dad was completely sober. In the late 1970s, my dad he started taking pain pills because of an injury. Actually, in the cabin, we're safe, but at one point we would have not been safe in the compound across the street from my father's house, because there were ostriches and buffalo here, of course, and those animals, some of them are aggressive. And Dad would just walk over here, and Dad would say, "Just don't get close to the buffalo, son." You know, right? And so I'd avoid the buffalo and the ostriches. But Dad was over here walking by himself one day with a stick in his hand, and the ostrich came up to him, you know, just sort of strutting its stuff, you know, angry as a male ostrich. And so you're stepping into my realm here, and got up in his face. And my dad took that stick and swung it at its neck. And he learned the hard way that you do not swing a stick at an ostrich's neck, because if you do, their instinct is to jump up in the air and try to kick you with their monstrous, horrible talons and disembowel you. This dad luckily was not disemboweled, but he did break 3 ribs. And so it was that accident.
He was, his injury, I mean, his stomach was torn open, correct?
It tore him open, but it, I mean, not his guts didn't come out.
Yes.
Or anything, but he bled a little bit, but it was bad, but it didn't disembowel him. But still, I think he broke 3 ribs, and that was the beginning, or so he says in his books, that was the beginning of his addiction to painkillers.
Right.
And by the time he was, by the time 1983 rolled around and I would have been 13 years old, he went through the Betty Ford Center and his life changed. And he really, really changed a lot about his life from then on. Although he had issues later down the line. Anyway, that's the nature of addiction. It keeps coming back, but things might change. So it could keep coming back to the right spot. But yeah. Dad, he always had a kindness and a love within him. And he really did, even through the worst years of his addiction that I saw, in my early teenage times, he just was incoherent. He just was not there. The person that I had known sort of disappeared through my father's addiction period to, pain pills in the early 1980s. And
how did that make you feel?
Oh, well, I was a kid, man, and we were on the road, together traveling, and my mother was there too. My mother was not using any sort of medications or taking any pills at all. And so she was a consummate codependent. My father was a consummate addict, and I was the consummate little kid right in the middle of it. And they did. They argued. They fought. Whatever. They had a lot of struggles. And they nearly divorced in the early 1980s. And this all in the books. And so it's easy. And then I say the books. I mean, it's in my father's autobiographies, which to me is still the most important ones to read. If you want to know more about Johnny Cash, read his autobiographies first, and then go from there. But I've also written a book about my father called The House of Cash, that is a sort of a coffee table book. But there's some of those stories in it also, as there are other books, autobiography about my mother called Anchored in Love. There are some wonderful biographies out there also. But my father, he truly, he really, really got to a point in his addiction where he was going to die. Something didn't change. And one night, we couldn't wake him up. And my mother and I, I was traveling on the road, always on the road. And we couldn't wake him up. And so we put him in the bathtub. And it was after that that things began to change. And it led to him going into the Betty Ford Center. And it really changed. He began to write a book. He'd been talking about it for a long time, but he really got in and finished a novel after that called Man in White. That is his only novel, finished novel, about the conversion of the Apostle Paul.
He was very much interested in Apostle Paul. It was, Paul was his mentor.
Ideally, Mr. Paul, we should be able to follow your direction. Ideally, this really hard to hang up to match up to what Paul had in mind for us as Christians sometimes.
Recovery from addiction is a spiritual journey, really, because it's a problem of the spirit and of the body. You yourself had some addiction problems growing up, like we all did as kids. We're all taking the stuff that was available at the time of our lives, I guess.
When I was 21 years old, I overdosed on psychedelic drugs, and it wasn't very pretty, but I wound up in a recovery center myself from that. And that was my first taste of what recovery was. It took a while for my mind to come back around to where it is right now. And then now everything's okay, right? Everybody out there that knows me knows I'm a little crazy still, but I was before that anyway. But off and on throughout my life. And, you know, I've had struggles. I've had my ups and downs. Since my 20s, I have more years without a drink than I do with a drink. And alcohol was always my thing.
But I myself had my struggles, for me, I turned of age in the 70s, and, cocaine was the drug of choice back then. And I remember People magazine even did a whole issue about how it was not addictive and it was just a fun party drug. It took till John Belushi overdosed with a cocktail for everybody to start waking up to what it was.
Those drugs that all have that in them that'll kill you, any of them are just horrendous. And then of course marijuana doesn't have that, but still it's you can definitely eat too much of it. It'll give you a horrible stomach ache. You smoke too much of it and you'll fall asleep.
Yes.
And I don't smoke, but
you can never have enough love.
You can definitely get sick eating marijuana.
Well, it's sounding like you got the message early. For me, it wasn't until like.
Well, I got the message early, but that's the nature of addiction, I think, too. It's like our memories as addicts are extremely short.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No matter how bright we may be, we can.
Our power to rationalize is very strong, too.
That's it.
Our genius is irrational.
Oh yeah, but I don't know. I mean, we're all people have labels. It's like you're an addict, you're an alcoholic, but whatever. I mean, it's just like we're humans. We're on our journey. We're all coming together, and we're all getting stronger. And I truly believe, that's the course that we're on. If we're on the course where we're looking for the light, if we're on the course where, the light is what's ahead, and it really is, and it's not a train about to hit us, then I think we're doing well.
To me, I look back and as in a way, I'm grateful for what I've gone through. At least I'm grateful for surviving it, but I'm also grateful because it has deepened me as a person in a way to really kind of go through struggles.
You're exactly right.
You think you're king of the world, you're indestructible, and that happens to other people, and it humbles you.
And that's it, man. I think that, sometimes a problem, but I mean, that's the deal. It's through these greatest struggles that we can learn the most. And, through my mother would say the strongest fire is what it makes, the toughest steel, but that's it. And that's what it is. I would not trade anything for my struggles.
Yeah.
And because it put me where I am. Now, of course there are, things that, I think we all look back and we have certain regrets and, we have to figure
that's
out.
A spiritual journey.
Where do we hurt others?
Did you grow up in the church, by the way?
I grew up, I was baptized when I was 9 years old. Yeah. Once in a church and once in the Jordan River. The church meant a whole lot more actually in my heart, because I think that's when I really gave over. There's a freedom that comes along with being a Christian. It just your salvation's in place, and there's like a root that no matter what, that that is there. And my father had that. It doesn't mean we don't fear. It doesn't mean it just means we hopefully can face our fears better and have a little more courage. But still, down at the core of it all, once I gave my heart to Christ, I know that I'm saved, and that's there. And, I'm not sure. Am I a Catholic? Yeah. Am I a Church of God member? Yeah. What book I'm going to carry into those churches? Same book. And so the book is what I hold, and that's the word. And then I want to learn from those who know the word better.
How is the coronavirus there? Have you been hearing reports?
Well, I think it's in rural areas. The things are still somewhat unaffected as far as like. If you compare it to downtown Nashville, where it's just very, very different. The neighborhoods, something to see how, it feels like the 1980s again. Everybody's out playing in the neighborhoods. All the kids are in their yards. People aren't getting in their car and hopping and going to the park if it's nice outside. Everybody's people are actually meeting their neighbors and saying hello. You know,
let me introduce myself.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, man,
we've been living next door to each other
for all these years, and I'm sure that's happening everywhere, even in Beverly Hills, which is crazy. That sounds
that's very much LA. We had the fires here a couple of months ago, and we had to, at 4 a.m. had to leave. Oh. You know, they got woken up and we came outside and leaving.
And Australia too.
I went next door. I saw my neighbor's house was dark. I went over and just rang the bell and kept ringing the bell until, you know, somebody answered. Because,
And then it just not a few days, you know, before really everything started to speed up with the virus, Nashville got hit by, a tornado. And it barreled through about 14 miles, I think, from where I am in Hendersonville, and caused a lot of damage. And a few people passed away, and a lot of destruction.
The way the people of Nashville came together for that so inspiring.
Yeah, and sometimes when the wind starts blowing, it blows for a little while, and I don't know how a better analogy, but I think maybe all the fires and everything, and the virus and everything, whatever, maybe it's connected, maybe it is, I don't know for sure, but it's it is what it is, and we'll see what happens. But Nashville itself is pretty comfortable, right now, but everybody is trying to make sure to stock up. Everybody is staying at home. It's very possible that they're just like it when anything really hard happens. I think a lot of humanity will unite. I think there's going to also be more sickness. At the same time, we were talking about alcoholism a little bit earlier, and I just sort of feel like that is going to rear its head, and with a lot of folks, maybe people that are one way or another, it's time to go out and find the light and the spirit and the beauty, trying to seek out those things. And I hope
you follow the light. I think this is the time for all of us to really reflect on what's really important. And finding out what's really important in life, sort of like pruning. And, I'm hopeful that there could be a spiritual revival.
I think when all this
is done.
Yeah,
it's going to be a different world on the other side of it. I know that.
Yeah, there's a lot of people out there that are afraid, and people that believe in God, sometimes the first time that they really do is when they're afraid. And we talk about addiction, and I talk about my fears that led me to the path of recovery. It's fear that put me there.
When you realize you can't do it yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And we need each other. And so I think we're going to all come closer together. I really do. I think that that is inevitable. And I think a few years down the line, we'll be very, very aware that that everything has changed. And I also think it's a period of adaptation. I think that if we are open to adaptation, and if we make the action to adapt, that it's going to only benefit us in the future to come, no matter what is to come.
I think all of us are dragged kicking and screaming into change. We all want change, but.
It's
really hard. You have to be careful what you ask God for.
Yeah, well, I think
give it to you.
Yeah, exactly, man. I think God just told us all to go to our rooms. My son Jack said that. I really do. I think basically he just told humanity, go to your room.
We were talking about faith and spiritual journeys. I was, when I was in my teens, I became disillusioned, I think, with church, with religion was really what it was. Not necessarily with Christianity, but with religion.
If we have a good heart, if we have a good soul, it's like God knows that. But I'm a Christian. I'm a Christian, and I believe in it.
With the red words of Jesus, and also just I've read the Bible twice. I've read the Quran. I've read the the Bhagavad Gita and the Dhammapada. And I always keep coming back to the Bible because everything there is in life, every experience you could possibly have, every feeling you could ever feel, is every lesson you could ever learn is right there.
It's true. It's all true.
Learn the hard way.
Yeah, it's true. And the thing, I mean, it's like, you know, we may find some old stories or new stories from the Bible, and we go, well, that's not true. That's man or whatever. But it is all true. And my father told me a story about, or he did not a story, but about how the Native American tribes in certain parts of what is now the United States, how they would, the indigenous peoples tribes would come together, and the wise men and the shamans from the tribes would all sit around the fire, and they would not speak the same language. And each of the head wise men would tell their story of creation in their language. And when they finished, all of the other wise men would nod and say, true, true, true. And that word was very widespread throughout the indigenous tribes of North America. And so then to the next one with his language, next one with her language, the next one with her language, and on around the circle until they were all finished. And they all agreed in truth.
Right. Yeah. In truth. Yeah. Because the way the Bible is written and all the great texts really is that they're written in such a way that you could take them literally, as my mother did. She believed that, you know, that it was all literal. Mm-hmm. You could also take it as symbolically. You can take it as a man of learning, or as there's so many levels of which it can be read by all kinds of people that it's still true.
And I think one common thing that happens out there is people, you know, equate religion, and we were talking about this a few moments ago, create religion and spirituality, and equate religion and spirituality, and that's not necessarily the way that the definitions are if you look in Webster. Right. They're not the same. The spirituality and religion are two different things. And what I've begun to understand is that religion is of man, and spirituality
religion is government to me.
Religion is of man, and spirituality is of God. But Christianity, also within the denominations or whatnot, it can also lose sight of what the true beauty is and what the word is, and it all comes back around to the word. In the beginning was the word, and the word was God. Anyway,
I feel like it all matches up with physics, the creation stories, especially go back to the math, goes back to the Big Bang.
Watch out, mathematics. and the golden ratio. Exactly. And the golden ratio, right? And 3.14, 5.6, whatever it is, going down the line. Pi. And you know, the beauty of a chambered nautilus spiral shell. So anyway, God is in the mass, and God is in our hearts. It's all true. Yeah.
Have you in your life, I know I have, that had a crisis in your faith?
Oh yeah,
had it shaken.
Oh yeah. And well, when I went through really, really struggled with drugs, in my early twenties, I felt empty and hollow and lost and alone and desperate and in need of in need of being filled. And I am so grateful. I'm so grateful that that emptiness has not returned. And even though I had, given my heart to Christ, I think I went through a change in my interior in my early 1920s where I emptied myself out because I burned my fuse so hard. And God was like, okay, I'll come back here in just a few minutes. Right. Yeah. because you're really, really dumb and you're going to put stuff in the ground. And so, I'm really glad that, you know, since then up to this point today, the emptiness has never returned because I know that my heart, you know, holds God. I know that. I know that it's not words. I know that in truth.
Yeah, I think that God does leave us alone when we are so intent on working it out ourselves.
And right, you know, and the moment we get it's like, who believes in God? Well, in a foxhole, yeah, we believe in God. When we're facing, something that we all have to come together for, boy, do we believe in God, right? And so, everything good is gonna come. Everything good is gonna come back. Everything beautiful will come back again. If things look dark, what do the Grateful Dead say? First days are the hardest days. Don't you worry anymore, because when life looks like I'm breaking some rule somewhere. When life looks like easy street, there's danger at the door. Right.
So. Right.
Yeah.
I think it was Rick Warren the other saying that a lot of these television preachers are, that God is the answer to a lot of your problems. So, you can get God to heal you. You can use the power of God. And a lot of times, God doesn't work that way. I serve God. God doesn't serve me. He's not there to take your order and fix it.
You're exactly right. We are here. He gave us freedom of will and mind. Yeah, we can do anything that we choose to do, and we can serve him, or we can serve up way too much for ourselves in a hot minute.
Yeah.
I can definitely gorge myself, but I'm definitely forgive the double entendre. But if we can keep our radar and keep our sights on our radar, then I think that we'll find that path, and God will give us a chance to find that service.
Well, yeah, I think that, happiness is a man thing, that we're a thing made of man that we're looking to have. But I think joy is really what God is trying to give us here on this earth.
Oh, yeah, man. Oh, yeah. And I'm so grateful. But described to me that happiness that, is sort of like standing outside and working. And when you stand outside and you work all day in the heat and you look up and then you feel this cool breeze blows through your hair, that's happiness.
Yeah. It's being in the present moment.
Yeah. But you sweated your butt off to get there. Right.
Let's kind of switch gears a little bit and talk about your own family. Your wife is a singer as
Anna
well.
Christina Cash, she's a wondrous singer. I'm excited about. She's got an album actually going to be released very soon called Shine.
Really, really excited about
that. I did produce that album. I did. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's got that coming out. ChristinaCash.com, and then anybody wants to find out more about me, JohnCarterCash.com. Also, my family is full of talent. My daughter Anna Maybell is a wonderful singer and guitar player. My son Joseph Cash. He's got songs on YouTube and SoundCloud and various places out there to be found. And he's a wonderful guitar player and a uniquely brilliant instrumentalist and a creator.
Oh, really? So, the guitar?
Yeah, he is. He's amazing. A guitar, and also he records himself, and he does loops and whatnot. It's a really unique music. Joseph Cash. They may be under Joe Cash.
What kind of music?
Exactly. It's experimental. I don't know, but I mean, that would probably cover too broad of a term. I really don't know what you would call it.
You sound like a parent now,
I know. Here we go. I know. Techno. No, that's from another generation. Hold on. Wait. I don't know. I really don't, because it's so unique. I mean, there's a lot of loops and beats and whatnot. There's a lot of repetition, of cycles, but he, it's not linear. There's not a chorus and a verse and a chorus and a verse.
Right.
Usually if you hear something, you probably won't hear that again, certain movement. You might, but it's going to be, four songs down the line or something. It's very unique. It's very brilliant. And it's his own unique, signature. It's not like nothing else. My son Jack is learning to play the piano, full of life and spirit. My little girl. And he's so brilliant. But my little girl, Anna Maybell Cash, she is now 2.5 years old, and she's already singing in harmony. If you hit a note, she won't find the octave for our musicians out there. She will find a harmony note instead. even with her little 2.5 year old voice.
That's a gift.
Yeah, it came from, well, Nita Carter, and grandmother Maybelle, and her mother, of course, Anna Christina Cash, equally as talented of a singer as my grandmother, my aunt Helen, and my mother, also wonderful harmony singers.
Going forward, you know, you're quite a filmmaker. The short film that I saw last year, you remind me very much of Sam Peckinpah in the way that, in your direction and in the look of your movies. And gosh, I hope the Westerns come back because you make a great Western director.
Man, I'm excited. You know, the short film is called Dragon Song, and I'm going to be making an announcement about the release date within the next few days from now. And I'm so excited to see that happening. It won Best Short Film, one festival last year, and then just won Best Western Short at another festival just now. Official selection at a number of festivals. And so, you know, I'm really excited to see it released and to see folks.
Is that something that you've kind of like hid under a basket all your life?
I've always loved. I mean, I'm a watcher, right? But I mean, I've always loved a certain style of filmmaking within that Western genre, and that being Peckinpah, akin to Getty Westerns. Also loved Heaven's Gate, beautifully shot, and not hardly anyone has seen it. Starring Chris Christopherson, but if you haven't, it's very, very, very long. But anyway, the way it's shot, it's just amazing, and the performances are amazing. Directed brilliant. It's just it's hard to get into.
Groundbreaking at the time.
Yeah, there's nothing like it. But anyway, that style. There's a lot of natural light, and then sometimes the dialogue is disjointed. Sometimes it's linear. Sometimes it's not. You question what's happening and who's who, and there's really not a hero. There's really not a bad guy. It's like everybody's sort of good and bad, and that's how my film is. It's also got a sort of a psychedelic piece in it. That's a time travel thing.
Those were the times of the anti-hero.
Yeah.
Back in those days.
Yeah, I love it. But Dragon Song is the name of that film, and based around it, it contains actually the full song that I wrote when I was 21, when I hit my hard rock bottom, set me to walk back up again. It was actually a song I wrote back then called Dragon Song, that is within the film.
Mm. Did you ever want to do anything else that was completely away from music?
Yeah.
Nothing to do with your family tradition?
Yeah, you bet. I come from many generations of preacher farmers. My father traced back the Cash lineage to around to the 13th century in Scotland. And William Cash, the mariner, was uncle to William Cash, his nephew. And I come from the nephew's line. Most of his direct descendants of the Cashes, anyway, and the Carters too, for this matter, were farmers, and then preachers also for a few generations back. Right now, my preacher farmer radar is tingling like Spider-Man senses. So that's there too. I mean, I wanted to be a fisherman, man, but it's creativity, right? But the truth is, the Cashes, it was like, and he was a mariner. My ancestor, my great 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 grandfather, but it was like a mariner, sailor, farmer, Johnny Cash.
The sailor part was how we got over here. Right?
Yeah. I mean, he didn't just ride on the boat; he was actually, you know, the captain of the boat. So, the nephew.
That's great. In fact, you're writing an opera.
Yes, an Appalachian rock, symphonic rock opera called Into the Sea with My Love. Most of the material I am working on with a wondrous musician named Matt Combs. He's co-writing some of the songs with me, most of them. Matt Combs is a great musician and a brilliant fiddle player, violinist, and mandolin player, among other instruments. And for those of you out there who don't know the difference between a fiddle and a violin, even though they look exactly alike and they tune the same, it matters whose hands they're in. He has the hands of both players. And so I'm working with him, and because it does cross, you know, the Appalachian traditional American music lines into more symphonic related orchestral lines, and also opera. It is most certainly an opera in the way that it's made up.
I think that's the most exciting things in life, and diving into things that are not our comfort zone, that get it, that where we really start to get out of ourselves.
True. Man, that's exactly it. And you know, it's, people say, it's like, well, are you a music producer? Or are you a creator? Because I have my own music also. I have an album coming out soon also, too, and my own music. And that's coming out here in December.
Well, you're a Renaissance fan.
Well, you know, I mean, creative energy is just flowing. And a lot of the nature of my creative energy is that I want to let what that flows be what is exciting and new and different, right? And if that happens to be filmmaking, if that happens to be an Appalachian rock symphonic opera, or if it happens to be more music production, I'm going to follow that creativity. I'm going to follow that light. My friend in the console room is laughing now that I said light this many times. However, he knows what I mean in unity. But I'm really grateful for the realm of creativity that is there for us to reach to. And it doesn't have to be film. It doesn't have to be music. It doesn't have to be one thing or another. We follow what we believe and what is beautiful. You know, man?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're doing music, and I love it.
That can be farming. It's really what your heart.
Your heart is. Yeah, your music too, man. I love your music. And I love what you do, you know? Man, did I tell you that?
I really hope to be getting together with you again real soon, and we would already be if it wasn't for this pandemic.
Every once in a while, there's got to be one come along. Every 7 or 8 generations, maybe 50. It's not funny, but I'm very grateful. That no matter what we go through as individuals or as humans as a whole, that there is hope and there is light. And we do not let it diminish if we supply the support and the strength for that light, it will lead us.
Our parents' generation. This is they call the greatest generation, and because of the trials that they faced. And I think we've had it really easy. The boomers and the millennials, from the boomers to the millennials, we've had it pretty easy. And I think this is where we actually, it's going to be a deepening experience for us.
You bet, man.
And I think we're going to grow as a human race over it.
Yeah. And the generation right now that is born, within the next couple, 3 years, and the ones that were born a couple, 3 years to the past, including my little 2.5-year-old girl, Grace June, it is up to us to support that generation and to bring them up with what strength that we can. And also to always supply hope and beauty and to bring that into their understanding and to keep love in the center. Because I mean, this is not new. That a virus moved this fast around the entire world is new, but we just are we're a small world. Everybody says it. Oh, it's a small world. It's a small world. Well, our small world just showed us really how small we really are. So what do? We go back into home, into the center, and I really think that's where it has to start, man. You know, and those of us like myself and that are flawed, it's like it's time to just be calm and to look up.
I really hope that, you know, there's a lot of divisiveness in this country, and I really hope that this goes a long way towards bringing us all together in a way. And I know also that there's people out there that are sheltering that weren't planning on sheltering with those people. And it brings all the problems and all the beauty to the surface. to be dealt with, those things that have not been dealt with. And no,
I know, and it's all relative, man. I'm so grateful, you know, because I mean, I'm just so grateful for everything that's come up to this, you know, in life up to this point. And I'm just praying every day to not take it for granted.
John, I love talking with you.
Yeah, man.
You couldn't be a better person to carry on the legacy of your parents. I think you're a great example to your kids. You're very human. I love the way you carry yourself.
Thank you. Yeah, you and I just got to be friends. Really, you know, closer friends. And I'm so grateful that we did. So let's talk again soon. And you know, I'm with you, my brother.
Same here, brother. All right, say hello to your family. Cool.
I will, Dennis.
Yeah. God bless you.
I'll talk to you soon.
Hey, everybody! Thank you for listening to this episode. And be sure to tune back in next Wednesday. I'll be talking with Billy Bush, and we'll be talking about second chances and Hollywood jail. Thanks for listening.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.